Good morning, and welcome to the LOPC First Friday Forum. We're so delighted that you could join us this beautiful morning, and with rain in the coming in, it's a perfect day. My name's Darlene James, and I'm a member of the First Friday Forum team. You may remember Larry Lamburn in January, who brought us up to date on our relationship with China and what to look for as we look forward, and our February speaker, Deanne Perrin, the Executive Director of Hope Solutions, who spoke on the interfaith housing for the Contra Costa County homeless. And today, Dr. Margaret Liu will bring us up to date on the COVID-19 and answer your questions. The First Friday Forum team feels it's a good lineup. And next month, we will have Dr. Raphael Danziger giving us a Middle East update. And of course, nothing's happening in the Middle East right now. A reminder about that date, Good Friday falls on April 2nd, the first Friday in April, and so we'll be here Friday, February 9 at 10 o'clock. The team members you'll see on the screen today are Mike Rusk, the current chair of the First Friday Forum team, Bobby Dodson, who will introduce our speaker, Devin Crane, our wonderful tech support, who's behind the beautiful picture of the quilt, and myself. Well, without further delay, here's Bobby.
Bobby, you're muted.
Okay, sorry. A year ago, I expect that none of us had even heard the word COVID-19. What a change this year has made. There are no new things to learn about the virus almost daily. We are privileged to present to the First Friday Forum audience, Dr. Margaret Liu, an eminent vaccine specialist. She says she is ready to answer any and all questions about COVID-19 and the vaccine. Dr. Liu is a world-renowned expert in the field of vaccines, immunotherapy, gene therapy, and global health. She has pioneered two important technologies for vaccines for treating cancer, which she has received numerous awards internationally, including two honorary doctorates. Margaret is known as, quote, the mother of DNA vaccines, unquote, and is a scientific lead for the World Health Organization drafting group, writing deadlines for mRNA vaccines. She has worked with Dr. Anthony Fauci numerous times, and during the last year has made many radio and television appearances during the pandemic. Perhaps you've seen her. Margaret obtained her MD degree from Harvard Medical School and completed her clinical and research training at Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School, and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She is well known to many of us LOPC members, as is her husband, Dr. Robert Johnson, who is also doing cancer research. They live in Lafayette and have two grown children. Well, we can't give Margaret a warm applause welcome like in days in the past when we met at the LOPC sanctuary, but I know we're thinking that. We are very proud to present our friend and a leading expert on vaccines, Dr. Margaret Liu, speaking on the topic COVID-19, what you need to know and do in March 2021. Thank you, Margaret, for coming.
Thank you very much, Bobby. And thank you, Darlene, also for that kind introduction. And I certainly am willing to answer any questions. I'm not sure I can answer every question, but I'd be more than happy to try. So let me get right into this talk. And what I want to start with are disclaimers, which I usually do because when I speak to medical groups that are getting medical education credits for this, I just wanted to highlight that I am on the scientific advisory board of the Jenner Institute, which developed the AstraZeneca vaccine. But I want to point out that we actually haven't had an SAB meeting since the the pandemic started, and I won't be discussing any proprietary information. So I only really worked on them when they were developing the vector. I haven't been working with them since they've been working specifically on the COVID vaccine. I also want to make sure you understand I won't be discussing any non-public information for my work with the WHO, where we're trying to develop guidelines for the for mRNA vaccines. So what will this talk cover? Well, I'm going to explain the different COVID vaccines. I'm going to tell you which vaccine to take, and the answer is whichever one you can get the soonest. But I'm going to explain why that's the correct answer for you as well as for the world. I'll discuss some side effects of the vaccines and questions about special cases. And then I'll discuss some of the concerns about the vaccines. And then I want to spend the last part of my talk talking about why these new mutant strains are so important. And I want to give you some guidelines and helpful ways to think about what you can do now that you or your loved ones are vaccinated, or if you're not, like me, I'm not vaccinated yet, just because of I'm not in one of the high risk groups yet. So I want to then, as the very final part, just discuss some ideas for how to approach what I call the voids of COVID, which are all of the gaps and the places in our lives that have had to change because of the pandemic. Now, you'll see that this slide has a green background, and that's because I'm doing something I've actually never done before, which is I'm actually going to kind of give you some slides that are more data, and that's the blue slides, and then slides in green that are kind of ways for you to think about making your own decisions or finding out information. And that's because no one can remember all of the facts, but what is important is how do you go about taking in information and making your decisions. So I'm going to talk to you about data and give you some of my recommendations. But then in the green slides, I want to give you some frameworks and strategies for you to use in gathering data and in making your own decisions about your life and your health related to COVID, or maybe other issues as well. And these points that I'm going to make are really this: verify the source of information and only use primary and trusted sources. So in other words, use data, not summaries, if at all possible, because I've found that even very well-meaning people, sometimes, especially if it's not their area of expertise, make summaries or statements that aren't necessarily the best ones, or they're too simplified, often is what the issue is. And I just want to explain to you why not to just forward emails, even if that email is supposedly from the CDC or has recommendations from a so-called unknown expert. And so then I just ask that you don't forward that unless you have verified the information. And I'm just going to start by setting the stage, which I think you guys all know for COVID, which is that, of course, events like Pearl Harbor and 9/11 were devastating for our country. And yet we can see that in a single day, a couple months ago, the deaths in that one day from COVID topped those deaths at Pearl Harbor on 9/11. And in fact, now we as a country have had over 500,000, over half a million deaths from COVID, which is more than the deaths that occurred during World War II, plus the Korean War, plus the Vietnam War. Now, one of the reasons this is so startling to me and to many people is that the United States has 4% of the global population, and yet we have 20% of the global deaths. Now, admittedly, out of that 2.5 million estimated deaths, I'm sure that there are actually more deaths than that because some countries don't keep track very well or they don't acknowledge COVID. But nevertheless, this means that we as a country, with one of the most sophisticated healthcare systems in the world, have a terrible track record. And part of the reason for this is that up until now, before the vaccines were made, the means of protecting ourselves were actually quite simple. They just involved masks and social distancing. And maybe it's that we're used to being able to take a pill or to use something high tech rather than something simple. But whatever the reason is, we're actually in bad shape as a country. And so this is one of the reasons I wanted to focus on how to help you all deal with your continuing medical education, which is how do you address this barrage of information that we're getting. And my main point is again, just to be rigorous about evaluating claims, and particularly before you pass them on. And that rigor includes whether the information is from a scientific publication or a Facebook post, because again, still sometimes the information has been simplified too much or maybe even misrepresented. I'm just going to give you one example. There have been a number of Facebook posts and even various emails that have been sent around starting towards the end of last year, falsely claiming that the CDC tally of 500,000 deaths due to COVID is incorrect. And they supposedly use numbers from the CDC website themselves and have said, oh, if you actually go to the CDC website, even their numbers don't add up. It turns out that the key numbers, the key data cited, weren't actually the real numbers. Some of them were, and that's what made it look like it was a legitimate post, but others weren't. And those numbers that weren't correct were in fact the numbers for the total deaths so far in the pandemic. What made it even harder for people to discern whether they were correct or not was sometimes they would include links to the CDC. And so it looked like this was like a footnote in a reference paper where it would say, here's the CDC, you know, dot such and such, such and such. But it turns out those were actually fake links. And so the data really wasn't correct, but it was made to look correct. So you just have to be both wise as serpents and harmless as doves regarding this pandemic. Okay, let me start with some really good news. That's actually great news. And then I'm going to talk about some really bad news. So the good news is that these vaccines work far better than anyone predicted. You may recall that last year the FDA said, well, as long as a vaccine has 50% efficacy. And that's because often the flu vaccine doesn't work very well, and it's a, you know, around there, 30 to 70%. And yet now there are three vaccines all authorized basically in less than a year, and others are in the pipeline and pretty near term in the pipeline. So the other thing that's happened is that masking has definitively been shown to work. So I think one of the problems early in the pandemic was that we all felt helpless. We didn't know how to protect ourselves from the virus. And now we know there is something we can do. In fact, more than one something, which is masking and social distancing, that actually work very well. And then you've probably heard more recently about double masking that works even better. And I'm going to explain about that. And one of the reasons that's really good news is that most of us still don't have access to the N95 masks. And so we kind of have these homemade masks and some surgical masks that have leakiness around the sides. And so we never really feel like they're doing very much, even though they are protective, but there are ways to make them even more protective. Okay, so here's the bad news. The bad news is that people are letting up too soon about not masking. The current levels are still really high, even though they're down from the peaks. The even worse news is the mutant strains. And I'm going to talk about these in more detail, but the bottom line is there are many strains. Some of them are more contagious. At least one of them, but maybe more, are more deadly. And they can reinfect people who already had COVID, which is scary because you usually think of once you've had a disease, you're protected, but these strains are different enough that you're not. And even worse, some of the vaccines that have specifically been tested in areas with these mutants appear to be weaker. And then some even worse news, which is that at least some of them appear to be more dangerous potentially in children, because we've always kind of assumed that the kids usually don't get very serious disease. And sometimes they don't even seem to have symptoms. Although there are some children who do get serious disease and have died. Any rate, this boils down to simple math. The more virus in the world, the more mutants arise. Well, here's actually the scope of the good news, which is there are now over 200 vaccines under development, of which 76 are actually in clinical trials. And this just shows you how they're moving through the pipeline. Phase three is when people do efficacy studies to see, does this vaccine appear to work? what a phase four study is after a vaccine has either been approved or given authorization, people continue to study the vaccine, because you can imagine doing something in a clinical trial is different from doing a study inside in the real world, where people drive up and get their arms injected, and maybe they aren't as careful about masking after they have got their shot as people who are in an official clinical trial. So you can see that these are ongoing, and you can look yourself on the WHO. They update this data twice a week to see how the different vaccines are progressing. Well, you can say it looks like the US may have enough vaccines by this summer. And so why do we need more vaccines? Well, we need more vaccines for the rest of the world, the 7.8 billion people in the world. But the other issue, and I want to really highlight this next one, is that different vaccines may induce different types of immunity that either work better against different strains of the virus, because so far we've been focusing on antibody responses, which have been very important to neutralize the virus. But there's another arm of immunity called the T cell response. And these T cells can sometimes be more effective against different strains than antibodies sometimes are. The other issue is that different vaccines may produce longer lasting immunity. So all our studies so far have looked at protection pretty early on. And what we don't know is how long will that protection last. So you shouldn't assume that a vaccine that may have slightly lower immunity in the short term, that it's worse in the long term, because they all have different mechanisms. And we just don't know yet how long these different vaccines will protect. The other issue that is hugely important, but not just for poor countries, but even for parts of the United States, particularly rural communities, is that the more stable a vaccine is, the less it needs super cold temperatures. If it can be stable at room temperature, for example, the easier it is to use. And so this is important for the US as well as the rest of the world. Okay, so you probably know that antibodies, basically these Y-shaped proteins, can bind to viruses and bacteria. And in the case of the COVID, they actually bind to a protein called spike that's on the outside of the virus. And what this does is this prevents the spike protein from binding to the ACE2 receptor, which is a receptor on the human cells that enables the virus to gain entry to the cell. So the focus has been on trying to prevent this interaction, and the vaccines have done a really good job of doing that. The challenge is that this receptor for the virus is distributed essentially everywhere in the body. So all these different organs. And this is one reason why the COVID infection can be so much more devastating than what we think of as influenza. Influenza is pretty much as a respiratory pathogen, so people get pneumonia. But with the SARS coronavirus 2, people end up with kidney failure. They end up with heart failure, as well as neurologic symptoms and so on, in addition to the pneumonia. So this is really a big deal. And it turns out that if people have other underlying conditions, such as obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, or other cardiovascular risks, this greatly increases their chance of having more severe disease. And, you know, I think so many people have one or the other and multiple of these. So if you get many of them combined, several of them combined, the risks are even greater. There's also this issue of what's called COVID long haulers. So some people, even people who had very minor infections or who are young people, and we generally think, oh, this isn't a disease that really is a big deal for young people. But even those young people who can have minor symptoms of the actual disease can have what's called now post-acute sequelae of SARS, PASC, which I think most people can just remember long haulers, but there are different estimates, 10 to 80% from symptoms for published studies. And this is in the absence of viral infection. So the people have beaten the virus. They no longer have virus, and yet they're still having symptoms. And I can tell you that my daughter-in-law in England had two roommates before she got married who traveled a lot. And so she got COVID, and she has had symptoms that have been aggravating. They're not serious, but they've been aggravating since then, that they've directly attributed to her otherwise not very severe case of COVID. So the other issue is this syndrome called MISC, which is multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. And this can occur even in kids who didn't seem to have COVID, but they were around people who had COVID. This can cause inflammation of many organs. And although it's very rare, it has resulted in some deaths in the United States. Now, this is just came out yesterday, so you're literally seeing something hot off the press. It turns out that the SARS coronavirus can bind to the blood group A antigen. Now, I don't know how many of you know what blood group type you are, but you can be A, B, or O. And if you have the A, the reason this may be an important observation, and this, by the way, was done at a group, I think, at Harvard, is that it turns out that this blood group O isn't just, or blood group A isn't just present on red blood cells, it's also present on the epithelial lining of your lungs. And so they think this is the reason why people who have blood group A appear to have more serious disease sometimes when they are infected. Okay, so let me tell you about the different vaccines. Well, the one that we most have heard about is our mRNA vaccines. And mRNA is just a little piece of RNA that gets put in a lipid nanoparticle. So I like to give the example that this is like an M&M where you have chocolate that can melt very easily. But if you put a candy coating on it, then the chocolate doesn't melt. So it's the same type of issue that our mRNA is actually very unstable. It gets degraded very easily and quickly wherever it is, but certainly in the body. So this is why it needs a coating. And the coating also helps it get delivered into cells. Another type of vaccine, which is the one that just also got authorization, is the Johnson & Johnson, which is a viral vector. So what this uses is this uses a virus called the adenovirus that causes diseases like a common cold. And what they've done, though, is remove some of that virus's own genes so it can no longer replicate. It cannot cause disease, but they've put in it the gene for the SARS coronavirus spike protein. So now this virus can still go in and infect people, but it doesn't cause disease, but it delivers this gene for the spike protein. So as with the mRNA vaccines, your body makes the virus, makes the viral protein itself. Now, an example of this for a licensed use vaccine is for an Ebola vaccine, which has been just developed in recent years using the same technology. The last one I'm going to talk about actually are recombinant protein vaccines. And this is where in the manufacturing plant, just the spike protein is made. And this is a technology that's been used for about 3 decades now. And the hepatitis B vaccine is an example of it. This is maybe the most important slide. And Monica Gandy, who is a professor at UCSF. And what she did was, you know, there's a lot of talk about the percent efficacy of this vaccine compared to that vaccine, et cetera. And it's all very confusing because different studies were done differently. They looked at different time periods after immunization, and they also measured slightly different parameters of how severe the infection was. But here's the punchline. They all, even including the Russian vaccine, gave a 100% protection from hospitalization and death due to COVID. So that's the most important because this is what you really want. I mean, you certainly don't want to still get a mild infection, but you definitely want to stay alive. And so some of the other differences, while they are there, actually aren't as important, but they're important still to have protection, but it's just hard to compare them because the studies were done looking at different time points. They were done at different times, which means when Pfizer and Moderna did their studies, there was much less virus around, and importantly, there were no mutants. And so fewer people, even in their placebo group, got infected generally than later on. And also we don't know how long any of these vaccines protect. So just looking at the numbers in the far right-hand column, I don't think you should necessarily say, well, that means that you know, one of the ones at the top is better than one of the ones at the bottom, because while their efficacy in the study was better, we don't yet know exactly for all these other parameters and in the real world. Okay, so let me just tell you a little bit more about how the mRNA vaccines work. So you probably know that we have our genes, our DNA, and DNA gets turned into mRNA. It's called a process called transcribing. It's like taking a secret message that's in code. And if you have the key, then you can turn that code into something else, into a sentence that gives you the message. This mRNA is what's the vaccine. Once it's delivered, you make the protein in your body yourself. And that is what the antibodies are directed against. So both vaccines, both Pfizer and Moderna, reduce the risk of symptomatic disease. What's not yet known is whether it prevents asymptomatic infection. And I'm going to explain why this is, but at least for now, it looks like there may be some protection against asymptomatic infection, but the numbers are really small. And so it's not yet definitive. And so you should assume if you've got these vaccines that you're protected from really severe disease like death and hospitalization, but you may not be protected from being infected, particularly it's only 95% effective anyway, right? So you know that people still got infected and symptomatic, but you also may be asymptomatically infected. And so it's not yet known whether an immunized person can actually infect someone else if they are asymptomatic and yet transmit the virus. I'm not going to go through this, but I'm putting this slide here with more details so that because I'm making my talk, the slides available afterwards, so you can look at this later. I think many people are interested in the questions about the safety data. The most important thing is that there are no serious long-term effects associated with these vaccines. And that's partly because the mRNA doesn't hang around very long. And so you get an immune response, but by then the mRNA has probably already been degraded. So there are adverse events. People get fatigue, they get headaches, tired, but these are considered typical of vaccines. In some cases, they are debilitating enough that people have advised that hospitals stagger their immunization so that not the whole department gets immunized, especially for the second vaccine, when people have more common side effects. They say, don't immunize the whole department on the same day or there'll be nobody there to staff the emergency room. So people have done that. and it is also a concern for older people that to make sure that if they have fevers, that people hydrate enough, because sometimes older people may not, some of the people in nursing homes, for example, may not be able to verbalize enough that they need more liquid. So things like that need to be paid attention to, but at least there's no serious long-term effects. And interestingly, young people seem to have more side effects actually with all three of the authorized vaccines. And it's probably because they're younger and have better, stronger immune systems. All of our immune systems start going downhill after about puberty when an organ called the thymus inverts. I'm sorry, I was typing, probably because their immune systems are stronger than older people. And I obviously got a phone call right in the middle of that. Okay, so the recombinant vector vaccines, like I mentioned, is the one that just got authorized. That's the J&J vaccine. There's another one that's being used in other countries, including England, made by AstraZeneca. And the data that just came out then, because this was just approved last Saturday, is that it is 100% effective against hospitalization and death. The big difference is it's one dose. And frankly, also, it can be kept at normal hospital refrigeration temperatures, which is a really big deal. I want to emphasize that this is still really good that it's one dose. So not for you to focus so much on saying, well, it's 85% versus 95%, et cetera. The other thing about it is that it was really important because it helped to show us what's happening with these mutant viruses. So this 85% effectiveness includes, they did studies in many different countries. So just to compare specifically the U.S. and South Africa, you can see that the vaccine was much less protective in South Africa. And that's because one of the main mutants is responsible for most of the infections in South Africa. Now, there's also some data, and the CDC acknowledges on their website that they say there is some data that this vaccine may protect against asymptomatic infection. And that's because they actually looked at this more than the other two previous vaccines did. Because if you're asymptomatic, you can't go tell someone, oh, please swab me. So you have to set it up for people to be automatically tested on certain dates. So it does look like this may be providing some protection against asymptomatic infection. I'm not going through the side effects because they're typical for these vaccines and pretty similar to the other ones that I mentioned in terms of the type of responses. I did want to discuss the one side effect that it has resulted in a change in recommendations, and that is anaphylaxis, even though it still is very rare. So it's only been about 5 cases per million with the Pfizer vaccine and 2.8 with the Moderna vaccine. There were no cases of anaphylaxis during the Johnson & Johnson clinical trial. However, there's one hypothesis that the anaphylaxis is due to a chemical that's used to stabilize these vaccines. So in the mRNA vaccines, it's this chemical called PEG, polyethylene glycol. And then the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has a related molecule, but not PEG, that's called polysorbate. And so if you know you have an allergy to either of these, then you can't take that vaccine. You might be able to take the other one. And so what you need to do if you know you have an allergy is consult with an allergist before you get the shots. But quite honestly, PEG is very commonly used in toothpaste, laxatives, and so on. And most people don't seem to have an allergy to it. And most of us actually don't know, but this is thought to be what the causes are. And I just put this list here. You don't really need to know, but people ask, what are all the components? And so I just wanted to show you that the polyethylene glycol and the polysorbate are present in these different vaccines. So if you have, what about if you have other allergies, like maybe eggs or peanut butter? The CDC says get vaccinated because they don't seem to cause you to have an allergy to that these vaccines. And of course, this is obvious to any of you who have allergies. You may be allergic to a bee sting, but you're not allergic to peanut butter. Or you may be allergic to peanut butter, but not other things. So just having allergies per se doesn't mean you shouldn't get the immunization. If you do have allergies to other vaccines, the CDC says to discuss with your physician. Now, again, usually allergies to other vaccines are for things like eggs, because certain of the influenza virus vaccines used to be or are made in eggs. There are different ones now that aren't made in eggs. And so there's no a priori reason that you would necessarily have an allergic response to these vaccines, but it's still best to discuss with your physician. In general, though, the benefits far outweigh the risks. Now, some people have asked me if they're pregnant or if they're breastfeeding, can they have vaccines? So just so you know, there's no concerning signs so far in animal studies. And they believe that the WHO and CDC, that there's unlikely to pose any risk to the person or the fetus, either the mRNA vaccines or other vaccines. And so especially if the pregnant woman is at high risk for COVID, such as a health worker or someone who has comorbidities, the idea is you should consult with your healthcare provider, but still generally the risk of the disease is much worse than any concerned risk about the vaccine. You may just want to take some acetaminophen to reduce any fever. Okay, the last vaccine that is the phase 3 in the US is still underway. It's further along elsewhere, is a recombinant protein. And this vaccine, again, the reason I'm showing it is that it had good efficacy in the UK, but poorer, although still efficacy, in South Africa, where most of the strains circulating are due to the mutants. So around May, we may be seeing this as being approved as well. So I'm gonna just spend a little bit of time answering questions that I get a lot, which are, do you need both doses? The answer is yes. So although you may get some protection against the coronavirus with one, it will be better with the booster. And it's not just higher titers, it's actually better quality antibody. And because we have these mutants, it's even more important to get the higher titers, because it's been shown that higher titers actually work better against, and this is some very, very recent data that's come out, against the strains when they test the level of neutralizing antibody. So even though you will hear, well, the Moderna vaccine still was able to neutralize the virus, that's true, but it was, the titer had gone down by sixfold. So there is the possibility that if people had COVID before, they might only need one dose, but there's certainly no harm in getting the second dose. It's just that some people who've already had it, when they get their first dose, they have such a whopping high titer that people think, well, maybe they don't need the second one. But you still are better off to get the second one, because not everybody who gets COVID actually makes antibodies when they have the disease. Now, it's very exciting that the J&J vaccine needs only one dose. But you need to recall that immunity still takes time to be generated. And different endpoints that they used in the study, they looked at 2 weeks and 4 weeks after the single immunization. So the bottom line is you still should consider yourself as not protected. I would say 4 weeks, even though by 2 weeks you will get some protection. So this is one potential advantage, given that the Moderna vaccine, you only get your second dose at 4 weeks, and then you need to wait 2 weeks. So there are some differences between the immunizations. So there's some other questions. Do people need to get the correct interval? What happens if you can't get your second shot scheduled? So the CDC recommends, well, use it correctly if possible. But if you end up being delayed even as much as 6 weeks because there's a shortage of vaccine or some other event, that's okay. You've probably been reading about how if you wait longer, and this is what Britain is doing, you then get a higher immune response. And I can tell you that that data didn't surprise me at all, because we've known this because of the mechanisms of the immune system. The concern is what happens before you get the boost, because your boost makes you have higher antibodies and better antibodies. They're called higher affinity antibodies. They bind more tightly. And so if you delay, you may then have a bigger window of vulnerability. Now, that's not such a big deal if you are talking about a disease that isn't circulating very much. Like, let's say you know your exposure to some other disease just isn't that great, like hepatitis A or something like that. But in today's day, when we have all these mutant strains arising and spreading, that means that you actually do want to get the high immune response as quickly as you can. The questions have arisen, can you mix and match? The recommendation is you try not to get them, but the CDC says if the vaccine you got is not available, then you can get a different mRNA vaccine. So you need to wait at least 4 weeks after the first, because that's the Moderna schedule, which is longer. But the bottom line is this is not how they were tested, even though it's likely the two mRNA vaccines would boost each other, but it's better just not to deal with that if you can. Okay, people ask, can you get COVID from the vaccines? No, you cannot, because this does not contain, none of the vaccines that we're talking about have the genes or have the whole virus particle. They're just basically presenting one of the proteins. Can the vaccines change a person's genes? The answer again is no. And the reason for this, I won't go through all of this, is basically this is a one-way street when you go from DNA to RNA to the protein. You don't go backwards. There are times for certain diseases when people can go from RNA to DNA, but it requires a very special kind of RNA and all these other enzymes around that. And this mRNA is just not the right, it's not structured properly. And this RNA can't go backwards into the nucleus to have that happen. So an mRNA vaccine will not integrate into a person's genes. I mentioned this briefly, but the big question is, should people who've already had COVID get vaccinated? And there's only, I'm just showing this slide because there are a couple of caveats. One is if you were really sick and you got, or if you got treated as Trump did with monoclonal antibodies, you need to wait 90 days before you get the vaccine. And the reason for that is that these monoclonal antibodies will sop up the vaccine that's made. So there's no harm. It just may not work. But if you were sick and you didn't receive monoclonal antibodies, you should get vaccinated definitely for all these reasons that people don't make immune responses and that there are new mutant strains. And sometimes the people who got it the first time are now getting more severe disease when they get a second infection. The CDC just yesterday came out with a new statement saying that if you just had COVID, you might opt to delay a little bit getting immunized because you may have antibodies that protect you, but there's no harm in getting immunized. And since you don't know whether you made antibodies to your infection, frankly, you know you will make antibodies to the vaccine. Okay, and also this some additional data that I wanted to highlight was a very new study that hasn't been peer reviewed but came from a very good group. This is really astonishing to me. They looked at Marine recruits. So these are guys 18 to 20 years old, and they're all presumably pretty healthy. And during a 6-week period, 10% of them got reinfected. Now, granted, they're living in close proximity in barracks, and they're all, you know, probably yelling a lot when they exercise and so on. But this is really an astonishing number that this many people would get reinfected. And as I said, sometimes they can be more serious, and certainly now some of the infections are due to mutated virus. So we've had a lot of recent success in decreasing the horrible, horrible daily numbers and deaths that we had earlier after all the travel from the holidays. But I want you to look at the far right side of this graph and look at two points here. The first is that we're still really high. And so everybody's celebrating how, well, we're in the red zone, but you know, we're in the red tier. We're not lower than that. So we're still about where we were in the summer. And this is still a lot because now we've got mutant virus. But the other thing that's of concern is look at how this decrease has all of a sudden plateaued. And so we're not continuing to go down. So is this just because, that the new mutants are here? It could be. But I want you to also understand that there is less testing going on. In fact, one tally that I saw looks like there's 25% less testing going on now. And the reason for that is, for example, Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles used to be a testing facility. It's now a facility to immunize people. And so although they're trying to set up other testing facilities, clearly when you suddenly take away a massive testing facility, the number of tests are going down. So even with fewer tests, we're seeing that when you would expect to see fewer cases, we're seeing that the number of cases actually has stabilized and maybe increased. So I think this is actually quite worrisome. And that leads me to the next part of my talk, which is the issue about these new strains. And I think it's sort of cute, but it drives the point home that some scientists are referring to these variants as scariants because they actually are very scary. And so even by the end of February already, we already have 10% of the strains in the US account are by mutants. And as I've said, in UK and South Africa, these are now the dominant strains. The reason they're dominant is because they mutate in different ways, but some of them bind more tightly to the receptor. So you can get exposed to fewer viral particles and get infected than with the old strains. Or one of the California mutants makes a cell produce more virus. So a person who's infected with the same amount of virus now is more infectious for other people. I also want you to know that the US has sequenced very few viruses. So when you see these cases of, oh, there's one person with this or six people with this, you know that's an underestimate because unfortunately we're way behind other countries in terms of the number of strains that we are sequencing. I'm not going to go through all the data on this slide, but just to highlight these points that they are more transmissible. Some of them may be more deadly. And the protection was shown in South Africa by three of the vaccines to be less effective against this mutant strain. So the implications for this is that, in fact, they think that the South African variant and others may have come about because people were infected, but their infection did not give them enough protection, complete protection. And so these new viruses developed in that, in under the protection supposedly of antibodies, but that weren't complete. This is important for us because if we now have people who assume that they're protected and they don't get the vaccine, or they don't get their second dose, and so they don't have very high titers, this may help more mutants arise in the US. This is the data about it, but the bottom line is that it's not, all the companies are now developing new vaccines, either to be specifically targeted to these mutants, or they're at least talking about giving booster shots. However, new mutations will likely arise, and we don't know what the vaccine efficacy will be against those. So, you know, Dr. Fauci says that there's a very high rate of reinfection, even for people who've already had COVID. Previous infection doesn't seem to protect you against the South African variant. And basically for the pandemic, it's a race between lowering infections by immunization and therefore it's how fast we can immunize people. So they are more infectious, they're more deadly. And the bottom line is this is not the time to relax masking and social distancing. It's so scary that many people and states are doing this because we have a chance now to actually squash the virus. And instead, even though we may think things look better now, depending on what happens next, it has been described as potentially being a COVID hurricane, that with the mutations, with the possibility of reinfection, with relaxed preventions, and possibly vaccine delays, such as we just had because of the weather, that we could end up with really much more severe COVID. I want to address, I don't know how many people listening to this are in the 20 to 49 age group, but if you have children who are in that age group, please remind them that they are the ones who are sustaining this resurgence of SARS coronavirus. And 65% of the vaccines originate from people in this age group. Now, that's often because they're working and so they have to be out and about, but it's also because of increased socialization in places like bars and restaurants by people in this age group compared to their wise elders who were staying isolated as possible. Okay, so here's now, I'm switching back to the green slides because this is the take home I want you guys to know, is that remember that the vaccines they're 100% protective against death and hospitalization, but they're not 100% protective against symptomatic disease. And even if you are protected, since it's not known if you can still get asymptomatic disease, you want to protect others. Now, I want to give you a little bit of immunology here, and most of you probably remember the polio vaccines. The injected polio vaccine made systemic protection, but it didn't actually protect people from getting infected because polio comes in through the mouth and it infects through the intestine. But people were protected from the disease because they had what are called systemic antibodies. If people took the oral vaccine, which was a live virus, they actually then could be protected in their gut, in their intestine, in the mucosal surfaces. So these vaccines are given intramuscularly. And so although there's some evidence they may also provide some protection from asymptomatic infection, in general, something that is given as a shot is not going to protect your mucosal surfaces as well as if someone develops an oral or a nasal vaccine, and people are working on this. Remember, the vaccines may not protect against new strains as well. And remember the math, that the less virus in circulation, the fewer new strains arise. So the other thing is, I just want to ask you to consider that you are an example for people. So even if you're immunized and you feel safe and you walk around wearing masks, that effectively gives other people permission to not wear masks. So just remember that mild COVID can result in long haul COVID, and 1/3 of infections are asymptomatic. So what happens if your whole group is immunized? Like if you live in a retirement community where everyone is immunized? Well, CDC has not given the recommendations and they were supposed to yesterday. I think this means there's a lot of discussion and disagreement that, but I would just say, use your common sense. You know, your risk is less than for an unimmunized person, but it's not 100%. And the risks go both ways, both for you getting sick and you infecting someone else. One thing that's very simple especially if you're still out and about, is double masking, because most of the mask people wear, really, frankly, especially because they don't fit very well, don't necessarily work very well. So if you use a surgical mask, the blue ones underneath, and then a cloth mask outside, the cloth mask actually fit better, but they don't actually filter very much. They only filter big Goombas if somebody coughs on you. So if you use these two, it turns out it's much, much better protection. In fact, one study estimated it was 95% protection, which is like an N95. And then some people I've actually advocated when I give medical grand rounds that they, if they do use an N95, they still should put one like a cloth mask or a surgical mask over it, because then you can throw away that top one if somebody, you know, when, because you're worried about bigger particles on it. And then that way the N95 can be used longer. It's really still not recommended to eat indoors with unvaccinated people. And if you do fly, which obviously there are still risks, but if you do fly, I thought one really neat suggestion was just don't eat when everybody else is eating, if you're going to eat, or frankly, you could try to not eat so you can keep your mask on all the time. But if you keep your mask on while everybody else is eating, at least you're not going to put yourself as much at risk. And then the airplanes actually have pretty good ventilation systems, but wait for a while after everyone puts their mask back on, because this will clear out the air and any, you know, virus that blows off of surfaces. Give it some time to clear out. And this was actually a recommendation from Dr. Wachto, who's the chief of medicine at UCSF. Okay, so this is a matter of our individual and collective vigilance over the next couple of months. So we've all lived this through a year, but the next few months are really going to be crucial, because what we really need to do is crush the vaccine in the next few weeks while more people are getting immunized, as we're trying to get up to herd immunity. And it really is just math. We don't want to worsen the pandemic, and we can help to slow down the pandemic by having less virus, fewer mutations. So how do we do this? Well, I figured this is a talk at LOPC. We're actually still in Lent, and Lent is usually a time when people think of what can they give up to try to acknowledge the suffering that Jesus went through. I'd like to say that I'm not going to say don't do that, but I'm going to say that let's, for COVID, try also doing something different. Let's focus on gratitude, because this has been a tough year and it's been so negative. And so maybe for the next 30 days or longer, we can focus on gratitude that you are immunized or others are immunized, even if you aren't. And that this mRNA technology, for example, it was first published on in 1990. And so this really isn't something that just got developed really suddenly. People have been working on it for decades. And so the fact that it was ready right now when the pandemic hit, as opposed to 20 years ago when the first SARS epidemic hit, but got crushed by very, very careful distancing and tracking down people and so on. We're blessed that this technology was available. Novavax has actually been a company for 33 years or something. This would be their first vaccine. So even though that's an older technology, we're very blessed that this time is when the technologies are available. We're also blessed that we have technologies to connect, because had this happened 20 years ago, we would not have been able to Zoom with our relatives and friends. Even though I know you guys are tired of them, it's much better than not having been in contact. I would also suggest that instead of feeling that wearing masks is an imposition on your freedoms, your personal freedoms, I would try to say, why don't you instead view it as a way to take joy in blessing others by protecting others and by setting an example for others. And then you can contribute that you are actually globally decreasing the chances for a mutant virus to emerge. So I'm just going to end on one other point. We've been talking all about us, and now we're talking about others because we want to protect your family and your community. But I think it's important to note what happened when polio came around. So polio was devastating because people died, people were paralyzed. And since many of these were children, it seemed particularly just devastating. So this is interesting. The vaccine was introduced in the United States, and you can see the cases just went plummeting down, screaming down, almost eradicated, and then it wasn't eliminated in the Western Hemisphere. But what's interesting is that the vaccine wasn't actually introduced until the incidence had already gone down. Nobody fully understands it, but they think that it's because everybody started basically socially distancing. They didn't let their kids play with other kids. And so the cases started coming down even before the vaccine was introduced. But the point I really wanted to make is this next slide. So you saw in the US that the cases essentially went to zero in the 60s and so on. It took another 30 years before that happened in the rest of the world. And this is just not appropriate that we don't care as much about people in other countries because their lives are just as valuable as our lives are. But another point, even from just a selfish point, is if there are cases anywhere in the world, they will spread. Because how did this happen? This happened from one place wherever it started, and now it's a pandemic around the world. So it doesn't really help just to eliminate COVID in the United States. We really do need broad, equitable, affordable access. And so with that, I would like to leave you with the resources for that you can look up. The WHO gives all the vaccines in development. The New York Times gives a nice tracker that shows how things are progressing. Sometimes I think they simplify things a little too much, but they're so it's not quite right, but it's for all practical purposes, I think they've done a good job. And the virus evolution tracker is very scary. If you like horror movies, just go to this instead to see how the virus is mutating. I'd also like to invite you to, I'm the chairman of the board of the International Society for Vaccines, and we give periodic seminars online that people can see what's happening. We have another one next Tuesday that I'll be moderating, addressing vaccine hesitancy. Why are people concerned? And what can we do to help educate people? Because frankly, the facts aren't enough. It's about how do you present information to people. We also have a YouTube channel, if you just look, International Society for Vaccines. So you can look up any of the previous talks and watch them there. So with that, I will end, and I'm happy then to answer questions, but I think Mike has some comments first.
Hi, this is Mike Russ. I want to thank you, Dr. Liu, for a detailed overview of the current state of the pandemic, for providing the information that we need today to make the best decisions for ourselves and to help our families and communities to better cope with the threat of COVID-19. And there was so much practical advice about what we should do. Devin, can you change the focus to me? Oh, the slide, that's good. Okay, I'm gonna take a few minutes to share some information and to give the speaker a chance to review the questions you have submitted. Just a reminder that you can submit a question by clicking on Q&A at the bottom of your screen. If you don't see it, Q&A should appear if you click in the black border area on your screen. Also want to thank Darlene James for hosting today's program and Bobby Dodson-Nielsen for introducing our speaker. In addition, I'd like to express appreciation to the other members of the First Friday Forum Committee and their efforts to find these great speakers and to make this all possible. So to Catherine Coleman, Caroline Gears, Nancy Holtzapfel, Tom Scoville, Joe Whitehouse, and Devin Crane, who's our AV technician. And without Devin, this is very difficult to do, as we learned. Next week, a video recording of today's program and the slides will be available on the First Friday Forum website, along with materials from other programs. So let's take a look at what the next three programs are. Darlene already mentioned April 9th. I'll also mention May 7th. David Seaborg, an environmental movement leader, is going to be talking about climate change. And on June 4th, Irene Blumgrad, professor of sociology, is going to be talking about immigration, which I think it looks like going to be a very important topic in the months coming ahead. last point I'll make is if you have a comment or suggestion, you can contact us at fff@lopc.org. You can use that email address. So, and now with the answers to the questions you have submitted, here's Margaret.
Right. Well, there's actually been a lot of really good questions, and some of them I do hope that I answered during my talk, and I'm looking at the times they came in. So hopefully some of them I've been, so what I'm going to do is just try to go through some of the ones that I think we haven't addressed yet. One of the questions was about a firefighter who actually had gotten the shot some time ago, and then because they're tested frequently, turned out he was infected now, but asymptomatically. And so the question is, can he spread the virus? And the answer is, yes, he can. And that's exactly why I was making the points, and people are concerned that people who have been immunized should not assume that A, they can't get infected, nor should they assume that B, they can't spread it to someone else. This is not a total get out of jail free card. What it means though is that he was asymptomatic. It's possible had he not had the vaccine that he would have been symptomatic and maybe even seriously ill. So this is, so he probably, in other words, is shedding less virus than he would have had. But I think that's actually a really great example of exactly the concern about people not assuming that they're completely protected. It also is a reason why we might end up needing booster shots. And this actually, I apologize because I used the word titer, and I should have explained that what that means is that's basically the level of antibody you have. So, after you get immunized, your titer or your level of antibody goes up. But in fact, over time, it drifts down, although you actually do have what are called memory responses. So the next time you see it, your body says, oh, I know this, I got it, I've already seen this. And it cranks out antibodies faster and to higher levels, and they're better antibodies than the first time you saw it. So that's what the titer means. And that's why people are hoping that even if your levels go down, that you will have be able to respond more quickly with memory responses. And by the way, I should say, I was told, and Mike, you may have said this while I was busy reading the questions, but I'm happy to stay here as long as people want. So I know we said, that normally goes to 11, but just keep asking questions. I'll keep answering. People asked about, will there be better responses in the future for pandemics? And there already before this one, there have been some organizations set up specifically. There's a coalition for epidemic preparedness. So we're trying. I think what's most important actually is besides the organizations that do surveillance to see when there are new diseases, is also now we know that we have platform technologies that can be cranked up very quickly to respond. So we want to not have them in the first place, but this is unprecedented to have three vaccines in the US within a year. Even a year ago, Dr. Fauci said, well, maybe 12 months, 18 months, but that was really kind of, we hoped it would happen, but we didn't know if it would work. And so now these technologies look like they're working. And if you think of mRNA, for example, it's kind of like knowing how to make ice cream. So once you know how to make ice cream, and you want to make a different flavor, it's a lot faster than if you have to figure out how to make it from scratch. And so that's why in the future, I think our responses will be better. Someone asked, is it safe for the long haulers to get the vaccine? There's actually, I didn't mention it because it's anecdotal evidence now. It's anecdotal, so it's not definitive, but some long haulers who have gotten immunized have actually had their symptoms go away. So you shouldn't take that as definitive. It's not been definitively proved, but it may be that what happened was they just needed a boost in their immune response to get rid of, it's thought that some of the long hauler symptoms may be because they're not still infected, but they still have pieces of the virus in some of these cells. And so maybe the vaccine helps to clean it up. Nobody really knows. As I said, it's anecdotal, but there does not appear to be a contraindication. In fact, some people have felt it was beneficial for them. So someone asked about what resources are good. And, actually was one of the nice things about the COVID vaccine is it's opened up the accessibility for a lot of publications. So for example, the New England Journal of Medicine has a resource you can access for free. In the past, you had to be a subscriber. Science Magazine is also in the top tier journals, and they have a lot of, you can access their articles, but more importantly, they also give these commentaries. And also a lot of the publications like in Lancet, for example, or JAMA, which are good medical journals, they often will have a, what does this paper show? Why is it important? You know, what's new about it? And that really helps because then even lay people can read the articles and understand what it's about rather than having to be so focused on, you know, understanding the complexities of a clinical trial. Someone asked about the double masking. Certain materials can make it worse because if you can't breathe, then you force air in and out of gaps. So what's important is first of all, there are some N95 masks that were used to filter particles coming in for workers who were like in construction. And so they filtered the air coming in, but they had these little flaps that the air would just blow out of. And so you cannot use that kind of N95 because that's actually worse for everybody else than, you know, if you had a different kind of mask on. And I think that the key thing is you do need to be careful what mask you buy. So like surgical mask, you look for, it has to have a label that says ASTMH or something on it. You can Google all this, but it basically is the organization, the regulatory body that ensures that they're the right quality. So I think the thing is, you know, the cloth masks are really just serving as a very gross barrier. So there's no concern about them, except that they don't work by themselves really very well at all. And so that's actually the issue. I think what people are concerned about making it worse is that the N95s that are, if you fit them properly, some people, even though their oxygenation is fine, some people just feel constricted, you know, about breathing. And so what happens is people fiddle with their masks, they take them off and so on. I think that's actually a bigger issue. Now, someone asked the important question about herd immunity. Herd immunity is when enough people in a population have immunity. So they've either been immunized or they've had the disease and that gives them protective immunity. So the challenge in the US is that, you know, before we had thought, well, maybe by the time in the UK was using this approach, they said, let's just let enough people get infected and then we'll have immunity. Well, first of all, that means a lot of people die if you take that approach. But secondly, we're now finding out that being infected once doesn't protect you, especially against these new mutants all the time. So what for the US herd immunity will likely mean is when we get enough people immunized. Nobody knows the exact number. Maybe 80%, 85%. Some people have used some lower numbers that it decreases your likelihood of getting infected because there will be few enough people who were infected that the virus isn't just spreading to people all over the place. Someone asked about me putting up the slide again about mutants. I can't see the questions when I do this, but you will have access to my whole slide deck. So please do that. So please know that you will have access to all of these things. Oh, there's a question about whether statins provide a protective effect because the virus binds to the ACE2 receptor. So statins is a different mechanism that works through a different enzyme called HMG-CoA reductase. There was a thought that maybe the people who use ACE inhibitors might have some protective effect. I think that a lot of those studies have, let's just say they've not been as definitive as the vaccine studies have been. The data proving that masking works, I will see if I can put that on because actually this was a study that was just, I just read it yesterday. So it's not been peer reviewed, but this particular one that where they did, sorry, not masking, masking works. And there are many studies for that. I was talking about double masking. There was a study that was just cited yesterday, but I think if you go on the CDC website, they actually have links to the studies about masking works, but there have now been multiple studies actually. So I can try to put them together so that when Devin sends out this, if, for people who want the slides, I'll try to put it. It's not thought that the vaccines are not man-made. It's thought this is just something that arose. And we've seen this. There's MERS, which was in camels and bats. There's SARS-1, which was in bats. So they're not man-made. Someone asked a question about how does the CDC count deaths from COVID? So this is actually interesting. And thank you for asking this question, Mary, because in fact, the counts for deaths from COVID is probably an undercount, because many of the people who have COVID have these other risk factors. They have cardiac disease, diabetes, and so on. And so what's listed as the cause of death might actually be listed as heart failure. And yet the heart failure was either exacerbated or may have even been caused by COVID. And so it's so complicated because many of these people have many conditions. So in fact, it's probably an undercount rather than an overcount for COVID, because you have to say, what did the person actually die from? You know, was it a heart attack but they also had COVID? They wouldn't be listed as a COVID patient. They'd be listed as dying from a heart attack. So the thought is if you've been vaccinated, and other people haven't been vaccinated, I will tell you personally, I try to do nothing, because I figure the less risk I take, then it's like, you know, if you aren't exposed to anybody, then you won't get the virus. On the other hand, I understand that, you know, you want to be with family. So I think the thinking now is if you are immunized, and as long as you are outdoors and maintaining social distancing, and when you're not eating, you're wearing masks, it's thought that it's okay for people to do that. It's just not thought to be safe to dine indoors, but it's thought that being outdoors is probably okay. And so the question is, can grandkids visit? You know, this is the thing is that if you're going to be inside and there are people who aren't immunized, I would still do masking and social distancing. It doesn't matter that they're your relations. It's like the recommendations that you still don't hang out inside dining and with other people who are immunized.
Margaret?
Yeah.
I want to thank you. We're coming up against a hard
deadline. Oh yeah, sorry about that.
We get going and we're so fascinated by what you're saying. We're all into it, but we do have a hard deadline. Darlene, you want to finish us up? Thank you.
I do want to thank Margaret for giving us her time and her expertise, and for all of you joining us. And we hope to see you next month on April 9th.